deliver in an agile way. So if you don't have all the data yet, or maybe you're not collecting yet, or maybe you haven't connected yet, find out what you can deliver to get you that much closer to where you want to get to. Don't devise a digitization strategy that has one goal line, and if you don't get to that goal line, you're a failure. There's got to be, you know, every yard line is a success that you've got to then build on from that standpoint, and take those wins when you can take them. Don't wait for the end of the big bang.
Hey, and welcome to the Interline Podcast. Depending on how long you've been listening to these shows, you might be hearing a new voice or a very old one. I'm Ben, I'm the Interline's Editor-in-Chief, and I'm hosting this episode because it falls squarely in my wheelhouse, which is reports and analysis. Specifically, this show is focused on Blue Cherry's latest report into the state of supply chains and the technology that supports them. The company's run those reports for 10 years now, making this the 10th anniversary edition, and I spent a bunch of time talking to Paul Magle, who is the president of Computer Generated Solutions, Inc. You'll hear Paul and I go through some of the biggest findings in the report in just a minute, but it probably won't come as a surprise that AI, economic uncertainty, reshoring, profitability, you know, four massive things that we've seen riding really high on Fashion's priority list over the last year are high on the agenda for this discussion as well. I've known Paul for a long time. Paul himself has spent a longer time evaluating how the fashion and retail industries work and then translating that understanding into briefs and directions for building real digital solutions. You'll hear both of those things come out in the conversation. The Interline's own AI report was published not too long before I talked to Paul as well, so you'll probably be able to identify some common trends between our coverage and the critical findings in the 10th annual Blue Cherry report. I'd encourage you to download and read both of them, so we'll put links to them in the episode notes for ease. For now, though, over to my conversation with Paul. Paul Magle, welcome to the Interline podcast. It's been a while.
It has been a while, so I'm glad to be here and be back and look forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. I'm going to get straight into it, I think, because a couple months ago, you released the latest in the series of Blue Cherry's State of Supply Chain and Technology reports. And if I'm right, you've been doing those for a decade now.
I was going to say this is actually our 10th anniversary edition.
Wow. Okay. So 10 years of this. In those 10 years, you've had a front row seat to see a lot of things change from a supply chain sourcing point of view and from a wider industry point of view as well. What do you think are the biggest developments or the biggest things that stand out to you that you've seen in those 10 years? And on the flip side, is there anything that took you by surprise?
Look, it's an interesting question. It's actually interesting to look back 10 years. You know, just looking back 5 years, it's amazing to understand that that's, you know, the start of the pandemic and COVID and how fast time is flying. 'Cause 10 years is actually not that long ago. But in 10 years, a lot has happened, and probably, you know, the biggest thing, and I'll say kind of the biggest three from my standpoint. One is what's going on with e-commerce is a big change, you know, especially if you start looking at the survey, how people were looking to grow their businesses, what their issues with the supply chain were, how they're trying to generate demand. E-com is a big inflection point in that. Second one, I think I would say, within the last 10 years is really just like almost supply chain disruption being the norm. You know, like I mentioned, you know, you had the pandemic, then you had Suez Canal getting blocked, then you had ships getting bombed. You know, now you got tariff wars, you know, just supply chain had been relatively stable, I think, prior to, nothing like it is now. And now it seems to be the norm that disruption is a norm. And obviously the third biggest thing right now is an AI standpoint. How do we harness the power of that new technology to really work on some of the things we've been talking about for the last 10 years, supply chain transparency, visibility, real-time access, all those types of things. So to me, those are kind of the three biggest things, and it's driving a lot of different things, right? We talked about the pandemic. You know, e-com has been, you asked me what was a surprise. E-com we saw coming, but when the pandemic hit, I wouldn't call it an innovation event, but it certainly came an acceleration event around e-com. All of a sudden, stuff that we thought would roll out over many years had to be rolled out over many days. So that created, you know, some technology challenges, but also created a number of opportunities. Certainly around the disruption of supply chain, we're starting to see a lot more conversations around nearshoring coming out of the survey, supply chain diversification coming out of that, and certainly supply chain digitization, which is, you know, the technology that's required to do all those things that people want to do.
I think it's really important that we kind of get to the bit that you just said around, you know, disruption effectively becoming the standard, becoming the norm. Because I think if this survey will have shown you anything, it's that that's the biggest challenge facing a massive number of organizations of all shapes and sizes right now. Where do you think the supply side of the industry is at when it comes to kind of reckoning with that and adapting to that level of ongoing disruption? Are we kind of prepared for what's coming, or is it more a case where the average brand, the average retailer, the average supplier is just reacting to crises as they originate?
Look, you know, I'll give you my first freaking answer. It's probably, it depends, right? So it depends on who you are, who you're talking to, which brand you're talking to. It depends on the relationships that they've built with their suppliers over the years and the types of relationships they have with their suppliers. It depends on how they look at their business and the KPIs and the metrics that they measure. Is it looking for the cheapest needle if you're in the apparel trade, or, you know, is it more demand driven and they need to do fast turnarounds and personalization? There's a whole host of things that come into that. And then it drives how fast of an adoption that you have to have. And then, you know, again, it also depends on what that disruption is, whether it's cotton prices doubling, as I said, you know, the canals backing up or tariffs is different things. But I think at the end of the day, and I actually posted something on LinkedIn yesterday, it's kind of, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. We've gone through these things now, whether it's pandemics, you know, whether it's tariffs. I think everybody knows now this is going to continue, and we've got to deploy technology so we can, you know, have better metrics and data. And again, it all starts with the data, because if you don't have good data, you can't do anything of the things we're going to speak about. You know, we've got to get this done now so that whatever the next thing is, we're in a much better position to be agile and react.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, right? So it's not necessarily about your ability to foresee the exact shape of what's coming, so much as it is your ability to have that kind of flexibility and that sort of agility to cope with whatever it might be as it originates. And I think looking at the survey, I think it was like 70%+ of people put that kind of uncertainty and their ability to respond to it at the top of the pile when it comes to kind of strategic challenges and so on.
That was actually the number one issue today. A lot of it was economic uncertainty. So when we did the survey, you know, the threat of tariffs was there. I think if we did the survey post-Liberation Day, April 2nd, probably one, no one would have answered because they were buried in trying to figure out how are they going to get goods in, or if they could get goods in, or if they could afford to get goods in, even if they could get them in. So timing's everything in some of these answers. But again, I think that whole theme of disruption that we've been talking about, and whether it's economic disruption or geopolitical disruption or pandemic disruptions, has been kind of at the top of the list for a while now.
Yeah. And in your experience, what have been some of the successful strategies that you've seen companies deploy to get ahead of challenges rather than just constantly be on the back foot?
Yeah, look, I will tell you that what people are doing, what I've been kind of suggesting, I think, is a couple of different areas. Certainly, you know, again, speaking from where I sit, as a software provider and a supply chain solutions provider, certainly linking digitally all of the links of your supply chain and utilizing the technology platform that can help you do that is certainly an important piece that you need to do. But it's not the only piece, right? Because when you deploy technology, I always say it's, you know, if you automate a broken process, it just makes it break down that much faster. So it's also taking a look at all of your business practices, your business processes, your relationships with your suppliers, right? I think we learned in the pandemic, people who got stuck holding the bag, and vendors who didn't get paid. You know, I said it earlier and I keep going back to it. It's all about the data. So in order for us to be agile, in order for us to link the supply chain, we've got to get data from our suppliers and from our partners. And if we don't have a mutually beneficial risk reward type contract or relationship, kind of the old ways people would hide things. You know, the manufacturers didn't want their customers to know exactly how much things cost or exactly where things were because they wanted some control. But you can't be agile unless you have real-time access to all of those things. You can't make decisions unless you know all the things. So if you can tie yourselves and join at the hip and be both successful at the same time, or both, you know, share some of the risk, you know, you can't digitize. So, you know, to your point, the ones who've been successful, one who are not afraid to invest in a technology platform and do that with a company who knows the industry space, who's got an open platform, who's got the ability to link all those links to supply chain. Those who are successful are the ones who have adapted their business processes and their business models to make it more of a shared risk reward type. And then the third one is those who have diversified their supply chain and not be in one location for everything, but they spread it out across and they've done the analysis to know where to go when and in what situation.
Yeah, but I think the other thing, like that level of kind of mutual benefit, mutual shared visibility and accountability that you talked about, that's also the driver and the unlock behind the degree of transparency that's needed in order to comply with a lot of different regional regulations. Now, I know the regulations themselves are pretty unpredictable in terms of how and when they're being enforced and where they're being rolled out. But there are examples, particularly in the US, of, you know, punitive enforcement when it comes to kind of transparency across the product journey. It's the same thing. That data that you're talking about, that visibility you're talking about, that mutual willingness to work together and share that you're talking about, it's not just an engine behind being flexible enough to succeed. It's about how much of that visibility can you share with stakeholders, whether they're consumers or legislators.
Yeah, no, look, you bring up an interesting point. It came up in the our most recent report as well, right? ESG and sustainability and all those things. If you go back a number of years, it was kind of high on the list of what people were working at and from a strategic standpoint. And this latest report, it kind of dropped kind of far down the list. And people were like, how can this be? There's more regulation, especially Europe and those types of things. And, you know, my interpretation of the data is it's table stakes now. It's not a strategic asset where people are wanting to replicate what Patagonia did, and that's their brand identity, and they're going to be sustainable because that's going to sell more goods. It's got to be part and parcel of your business. And the good news is those who have been concerned about the cost that it is to be able to report the types of things that the regulators want from a sustainability standpoint, once you build that infrastructure, all the other things we talked about being agile in your supply chain, being able to make better decisions, it's all the same infrastructure. So it's not a separate set of investments. It's one investment across digitizing the supply chain that allows you to do all the things you just talked about. Answer to the regulators, answer to your customers, answer to your suppliers, and then be a much more efficient and effective organization, and then be able to take advantage of the new technology as it comes out, whether that's AI or blockchain or whatever it may be.
I think that's a really great point. It's not doubling up on effort. It's one level of effort, one level of digitization that serves multiple different outcomes, all of which are things that the wider market is asking for or demanding, or things that brands, retailers, suppliers can use to get ahead of what the market's going to be asking. It's funny you mentioned kind of sustainability, ESG, CSR, kind of falling off the radar a little bit in this year's report, because I think you've got a really good example of something that did the opposite, which was nearshoring as a sourcing strategy, staging a big comeback. So surging from something like, I think you had it around 15% up to like 45% as a top priority this year. It's a big jump. Do you think that's being driven by some of the like near-term tariffs and trade policy and some of what are hopefully kind of shorter-lived disruptions? Do you think that's actually maybe a long-term change to sourcing strategies?
Look, I think it will be a long-term change ultimately. What I will add to that is it's been talked about for a long time about being a change in strategies. To answer your question specifically, yes, I think it's being driven now as a risk mitigation strategy against certainly tariffs now. Certainly, you know, 5 years ago in 2020, it was about pandemics. You know, there's a lot of geopolitical things going on. So I think everybody's learning. And again, it's not a new lesson, right? You've got to diversify. A lot of people look at it on the revenue side. I want to diversify. I don't want all my revenue coming from a Walmart or from a, you know, whatever it may be, Primark or something like that. But you also got to do that on the supply chain side. You've got to diversify there because, you know, if something happens, you've still got to be able to produce. And again, everyone used to chase the lowest cost of the product, but you've got to have visibility so you really understand that total landed cost and also the cost of opportunity if you can't react as quickly enough. You know, if you can't do a 6-month lead time and you miss a demand curve, but you could do it because you're nearshoring, and maybe it's the garment costs more, but you know, maybe you can charge more for it, right? I will say that, you know, as much as things have changed, and we look at our reports over the last 10 years and things have changed, it's always about the right product at the right price at the right time, right? It's gotten much, much more complex to deliver that and measure that and do it in a much more accelerated rate, as could, because that's what the consumers are demanding, not only faster, but more personalization and wanting more information about where things are coming from and those types of things. So it's more complicated to get the right product at the right price at the right time. But the good news is we've got the tool sets and we've got the capabilities, and companies are sophisticated enough to handle that going forward. It's just, as I said, everything is accelerating.
Yeah, and that makes it much more complex if you are 100% wedded to the traditional sourcing paradigm, if you like. Like, if you're unwilling to challenge some of that, then that complexity and that speed increase and everything is just going to continue to mount. So I guess it's probably right that companies are looking at variables like, you know, reshoring, nearshoring, things that historically they wouldn't have had to lean into or wouldn't have had to move, and now sort of saying, well, the rest of the picture, all of these other variables are changing. We're going to have to look at pulling this one at the very least. We're going to have to evaluate it, and we're going to have to evaluate it from beyond the point of view of unit cost and look at that bigger picture, like you said.
No, exactly, right? And again, then along the, what comes along with that is the investment in the infrastructure, right? Because it's one thing about having the labor nearshore, but if you still need the materials and you still need the raw materials and you still need mills and, you know, all of that has to come along with it. Because if, you know, you don't want to source in Asia, but that's where all your material is coming out of, you know, you still got a little bit of a problem. So I think that's why it's been talked about a lot, but slow to come. But I think what we're starting to see now, and it's not just from the brands themselves, but the governments of these nearshore locations are starting to invest in the infrastructure and attract kind of a vertical type mindset. So everything is in whatever region it is that people are looking at. So that truly are de-risking that supply chain, because it doesn't help to have people ready, willing, and able to sew if they have no raw materials, right?
100%. And particularly, you know, for your audience in the US and for our audience here in Europe, you have kind of North Africa in our case, for Europe and the UK. You have Central America, a bunch of different countries there that are specializing in different areas and trying to get as much of that vertical slice within one place as they can so that they can become more predictable and less kind of risk prone partners. So it's interesting to see that wider, like, geopolitical infrastructure and government support and everything being built out in recognition of the fact that people do want to be able to source not just sewing capacity and production capacity, but entire kind of end-to-end components and materials and everything else that they need.
Absolutely. And again, I also want to share some things that just because you kind of brought it up, and just make sure that, as you mentioned, your audience and my audience, it's really our audience, right? Because again, as a company, we've been expanding globally over the last number of years. We've got a big investment going on in EMEA right now. We've got a number of customers there. We're localizing all of our products there. And we're growing across Europe, Middle East, Africa, Asia as well, the LATAM region, and certainly deeper and wider into the United States and Canada. So our audience is, there is no your audience or my audience. Our audience is our audience.
Amazing. And the more I think about it, actually, the US is probably our biggest audience of readers these days as well. So it's a very global perspective. I think I'm thinking more from the point of view of me living in the UK as a shopper. And
you, yeah, no, I know. We're both sitting somewhere. But again, I want to make sure too that the people listening know that we've really expanded our reach and our value proposition. And we've got people in each of those regions that can bring value to the, amazing, to the folks in the industries that we target.
Cool. That's a really good point. Shifting gears slightly, but talking about something else that's maybe kind of been simmering for a while, but is now suddenly become a key priority, and that would be AI. So looking at your report, I think 90%+ of people said that they consider AI insights to be a key priority. That mirrors what we've seen industry-wide and across a bunch of different kind of processes and job roles and functions and everything else. What we're also seeing, particularly at the moment, because we're gearing up to publish our AI report about 10 days from the date of this recording, What we're seeing is that we're kind of moving from AI as a broad set of possibilities, just like general purpose capabilities, towards AI in products and in discrete applications. Tell me what you think that looks like from the supply chain decision-making side. Like, where are we on that transition from AI is coming and it's going to have a significant impact to AI is here and it's manifested and expressed as specific products and discrete applications that you can go use and obtain value from today?
Yeah, look, I think everything you said is still true today, right? AI is still in its infancy. So it's still coming and it's still being built out, but it's also being moved into production applications and getting specific use cases as well. And there's a tremendous amount more to come from an AI standpoint. I will say that from where I sit, and again, being someone who's responsible for a software business, I would say that if I'm not saying AI every other word in a sentence, I have no credibility anymore. But, you know, it's another power tool that's available for us that we've got to really learn and make sure we bring it into our platform and to everything we do in a manner that makes sense for us, because it's still evolving. It's still being commercialized in a lot of different ways. The major vendors are still bringing it into their tool sets. You know, so when I speak about AI within my organization, I kind of talk about the three P's of AI: productivity, process, and then product when it comes to our supply chain platform. On the productivity side, you know, to your point, there's use cases. It's already done. Microsoft has Copilot. Every email people are writing, every task they have, every workflow, we should be looking at how AI can help us be more efficient as a organization, as a company, as an individual, right? Everybody needs to look at their job and learn how to use AI to do more with less. On the process side, same thing, right? We interact with our organizations, with our customers, and we use tool sets around that. So make sure we understand the tools that we are utilizing, what AI capabilities we can put into those so we can adapt our process to use those pieces. And then on the product side, certainly from our standpoint, we're looking at all the things that you spoke about, which you asked about on the supply chain side. We've just come out with an AI-based planning tool, inventory planning, replenishment. Our new platform has AI inherently built in for intelligent search and making things more easy. We built tool sets to create dashboards based on the data. And again, as I mentioned, data, I always say you can't do AI if you don't have clean data. So it's also very important before you go down the AI path, you go down a data strategy path within your organization. Make sure that, one, you're collecting all of the appropriate data that you need to. Two, it's being validated on the way in to your organization and contextualized as well. And three, you're building KPIs and key performance indicators and metrics that you want to measure so you know how to bring that data out and you know how to utilize AI effectively and appropriately, right? And again, everyone's heard the term hallucinations and AI. You know, I always say, if you ask AI the same question twice, you get the same answer twice. And if the answer is no, you know, that means you've got to be smart enough to really know how to use that tool. You know, when you swing a hammer versus when you twist a screwdriver, rather than swinging the back end of the screwdriver. You know, they both might be able to put a nail in. One's a little more efficient than the other. That might be the right way, the wrong way. So all about the data, make sure you've got that data integrity in place. And then make sure you know what you want to measure and implement. And also, you know, things are changing on a daily basis. 5 new companies today, 5 gone tomorrow. The prices are changing rapidly as people are building out these models. To your point, these agents are getting very specialized. Agents are going to start in the future talking amongst each other. So, you know, not everyone has to be an LLM builder. You know, you've just got to make sure as you're deploying technology, because, you know, that's kind of some of the things we've been talking about a lot. You've got platforms that are open, have APIs, know how to interact and move data back and forth. And again, you've got a clean set of data that then AI can be trained on.
Yeah, 100%. And one of the things that we see, and I see just as somebody observing tech at a consumer level as well, people kind of point to the AI hallucination issue too often when the root cause of a lot of issues is that the data was incorrect to begin with, or the tools that were used to scrape the data and then serve it up to the LLM were incorrect to begin with. There's only, I'm not saying that AI doesn't hallucinate, large language models certainly have been known to, but in a lot of cases where it's returning kind of faulty results or less than optimal results, the root cause is the information it's being fed or the tools that it's being given or that people are using around it to obtain that. And I think you said something really smart, which is it's about learning whatever, whether you're in supply chain, whether you're in any other kind of discipline within fashion and retail. It's about learning when to use AI and how to use it. And that means engaging with it in some capacity. And it means, especially from, you know, from your point of view, it means incorporating it into products in a way that's sensible and sensitive and logical and stands the greatest chance of delivering like accurate returns as well. And when we think about what that means for kind of skills development in the workforce in general in AI, would you align with that idea that it's not going to be an instant replacement for supply chain professionals and people who task with material development and procurement and sourcing, but it's more likely to be an augment to those job roles, at least in the short term?
Yeah, look, I think like anything else, and again, well, let's talk specifically around supply chain, right? That's a knowledge worker position, you know, from my perspective, right? So again, we're giving them a power tool now to get through their job much faster. Like any technology deployment over time, as people get more productive, you know, there's hiring avoidance as you grow. You know, they may be able to deploy somebody now that they're more productive and give them more skill sets or put them in a new role and everything else. I'm not one who thinks AI is going to replace every human being, you know, that has a job going forward. I think the human element is going to continue to be real, real important. But I think the same way email changed our world, you know, the internet changed our world, the telephone, the steam engine, all of those things changed our world. AI will change our world. And as I said earlier, we're in the infancy of it. But I think in the end of the day, all of these things always made us more productive, more successful, and has allowed the world to grow. So
that's a really good conclusion. Just thinking about what we said there about the validity of data and the importance of data. Your report kind of suggests that when we look upstream, there's reason to maybe be a little concerned at the moment about the accuracy and maybe not the accuracy, but the way that data is structured, the way it's consolidated and the systems that are used to kind of communicate it, share it between manufacturers, suppliers and their brand customers. I think in your report, something like a third of manufacturers still rely heavily on spreadsheets and manual data entry. What impact do you think that kind of gap in maturity, if you want to call it that, like digital maturity, is likely to have on how we frame the sourcing and the supply chain challenges that businesses are going through at the moment? And in particular, I guess, how that impacts what you can do with AI and anything else that you want to layer on top of that data?
Yeah, look, you know, you almost answered the question, right? Without data, you can't do any of these things, right? Without trusted data. You know, let's take ESG for example, right? These brands are going to be on the hook for ESG reporting. You know, and I, you know, when we talk about ESG, you know, I say as a technology guy, ESG is simple to me. It's just another field in the database, right? I just have to be able to collect the data and then tie it together to a PO, tie it together to, you know, what consumer bought it, be able to publish it on a label, be able to publish it to the government. But the validation of that data that someone put in there, your point, if it's coming off a manual spreadsheet, how do we know when we're reporting that that's the right data? Or if we don't have those relationships that we talked about earlier that have to be built with your supplier, that you've got shared risk and shared reward, how do we know that they're not just telling us what we want to hear without some sort of validation? So again, to your point, supply chain leaders are also looking to validate that data. So, you know, there are companies now that have satellites in the sky that are looking at factories and how many apartments are near the factory, how many trucks are there, where the trucks are coming from. And they're starting to validate data saying, okay, they said this came from this region. Yeah, we can actually see and we can pull the documents from all these websites and see the documents. So we know it was shipped. We know where it came from. We can validate all of that. So yes, it's all about the data. Yes, there are some blind spots within the data And yes, because of all the demands, again, government demands, consumer demands, stakeholder demands, that white space is being filled by vendors and things. And again, the more data you have, the faster you have to get through it. And that's where AI comes in, right? Very efficient and effective to rifle through the data. Again, uses a lot of resources and those things, and we're finding about that about as well. So you'll see as the AI models grow and things, and the infrastructure that's required to continue to fuel that, is all going to come into. And that's why I keep saying we're at the infancy. We'll see how it grows, but it is one of those the next inflection points, I think, from a technological standpoint.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you on that one. The other thing about your report as well, so it's not, you have the survey portion of it. You also got some interesting case studies of companies like Le Bihan Rose, Grey Matter Concepts, the kind of organizations who made big strategic bets on using technology to support the next evolution, the next kind of inflection point of their own sourcing and supply chain strategies, whether that's, you know, nearshoring, some broad spectrum digitization, data, whatever it is. Like, these are companies that have walked the talk, as it were. Based on your knowledge of those, what do you think our listeners can learn from those kinds of case studies? Is there anything in common that those have, anything that they all did that was consistent, or anything that separates them that you think that is maybe a teachable moment for the people listening to this?
Yeah, look, they're all different in terms of what they wanted to accomplish and how they deploy technology. But I think, you know, what's common among them all is a vision of what they want to accomplish by having that data, by having that connected supply chain, and really by having a mission, right? So whether it's Grey Matter, who's trying to build the most sustainable, ethical supply chain process within kind of, you know, basic goods, right? Socks and undergarments and those things, but do it in a sustainable, ethical, you know, vertical way. They knew technology deployment would be important for that. You know, Le Bihan Rose, large company, bringing together a number of technological platforms, consolidating them down from an efficiency and effectiveness and visibility standpoint. You know, Confexa, to drive efficiencies at their factory floor through connections to like industry 4.0 IoT devices, and then being able to provide real-time data to their customers for a competitive edge. I think, like I said, they all had kind of different missions, but they all had a mission, which then meant we had a clear vision from the top of what they wanted to accomplish. It permeated throughout the organization, which allowed them to be successful. And then everyone knew kind of where the goal line was, or where the try line was. So they knew when they would be successful and what they were running after.
Amazing. And then when you look at case studies, whenever anybody looks at case studies, it's easy to come away thinking, okay, the technology is what I need to accomplish this. All I need is the right solution. I need the right application, and I'll be able to follow in these people's footsteps. I think to me that feels like a bit of a misconception, because there's a much bigger kind of process transformation and cultural transformation that would have happened at those companies and then at a bunch of other ones as well. What's your take on that kind of continuum between changing the way you operate and investing in tools? I know the two go hand in hand, but I also know from a lot of the Interlines experience that people tend to see technology as the sole solution, that it's going to pull everything else forward with it.
Look, you know, if you go back through this entire conversation in the last 40 minutes or so, you know, and you're interviewing a technology executive, we didn't talk about any specific technology at all. And we didn't bring up technology in terms of being solutions, right? We all talked about business process, supplier and vendor relationships, the ability to be able to have the right data and understand how you want to interpret it, how you want to contextualize it, you know, and have business processes that are sound, right? And then you got to start, and then you look at the enablers, right? Because if you don't have any of that, you know, you can't deploy technology. You know, again, from where I sit, I'm biased, right? I think we have the best purpose-built supply chain platform for this, you know, industries that we serve, the brands, the retailers, you know, apparel, footwear and accessories type companies. And I think we've built in a lot of things that are necessary to execute on business strategy that's required for these industries. But to your point, it's an enabler. It's a tool. And if you don't do that up front, business side of it, I don't care whose tool you have, it's gonna fail, right? So it's first and foremost, know what you're chasing after, know what you want to accomplish. And then you can take that and then you can validate against the technology platforms. Okay, in order for me to accomplish this, I need an open platform that has APIs, allow me to connect to everybody. It's purpose-built for my industry. So all of the data elements that I need are already there. All of the processes and retailer compliance rules and all the different terminology, and even the people within the company know how to talk to my team and can bring best practices because they're working with many companies in the same industry. And then you can vet all of that stuff out to make sure that the partner that you're picking, the vendor that you're picking, the platform has everything you need that you've already identified that you need. You know, don't buy technology without knowing what you're going after and then trying to figure it out after you have the technology platform. Okay, now how do I solve my problems with this platform? It needs to be the other way around. I know how to solve my problems. Can this platform facilitate that?
Yeah, that's a really great way to frame it. And it's clear you spent a lot of time thinking about how strategy maps to solutions, and specifically in that order. Now, in the report, I think you got a line in there about how the old playbook for sourcing supply chain is obsolete. If you think about what everything that you've just said and what that means for companies who need to identify the moves in a new playbook and then go map those to specific solutions, what do you think is a kind of a first principle that companies should be looking at when they're thinking about that transition from an old way of working to a new way of working? Where do they start?
Look, at the risk of being, kind of repetitive, you know, if you kind of look at everything we've been talking about, and when I keep saying kind of it's all about the data, no matter what you're deploying, it's, you know, start with a data strategy, define the KPIs, you know, the key performance indicators, the business metrics that you want to have and accomplish and you want to measure on. Make sure you understand all the links in your supply chain and you have no blind spots. And again, I think the most important thing to remember in all of this is deliver in an agile way. And again, coming from a software background, you know, the old way we would deliver things was the waterfall method. You know, you would finish something and then move on to the next and then deliver it when it was complete. You know, with agile, as you're building and as pieces are working, you're deploying those and then you're building on it. Same thing here. You know, if you've got links in your supply chain that aren't digitized yet, and to your point earlier, they're still in a spreadsheet, let's figure out a way how to get that spreadsheet data loaded. How to get it loaded, make sure it's validated, make sure it comes in, and don't just keep it offline. Because a lot of these organizations we go into, they have all sorts of data, but it's offline. And, you know, they're not bringing it into a centralized location. So it's, you know, deliver in an agile way. So if you don't have all the data yet, or maybe you're not collecting yet, or maybe you haven't connected it yet, find out what you can deliver to get you that much closer to where you want to get to. Don't devise a digitization strategy that has one goal line. And if you don't get to that goal line, you're a failure. There's got to be, you know, every yard line is a success that you've got to then build on from that standpoint and take those wins when you can take them. Don't wait for the end for the big bang. You know, if you've got data, provide it, share it, bring it in, learn from it, find out what other holes you may have or blind spots you may have, identify where that data exists, bring it in, understand how to validate it. And there's a whole host of ways to do that, from platforms to data warehouse strategies to data strategies to, you know, purpose-built modules that you can bolt onto your ERP systems or to your PLM systems. So, you know, again, back to your tight questions, having a clear-eyed view of what you want to accomplish and then deliver and identify what you need in an agile way so you can reap the benefits and continue on the journey.
Yeah. Okay. And do you, that kind of data isolation that you're talking about where people have a lot of information and it's not connected or it's kept closely guarded or it's not shared with the right people. Do you think that's the biggest roadblock to the industry? I'm using it as shorthand for fashion, retail, consumer products, and so on. Do you think that's the biggest roadblock standing in the way of having a fully connected supply chain, or are there other barriers in there as well?
Look, I think, you know, I hate to say what's the biggest roadblock, right? Because again, it goes back to my most common answer again, it depends, right? Some organizations, the biggest roadblock is that you know, leadership is not convinced and they're not given the investment that's required to build some of this infrastructure, right? Some of it is, yes, things are offline, so people don't even know what they have, and they don't know where to begin. So that's a piece, right? Others, to your point, you know, they don't have the relationship so they can get at the data. So they got to start working first on the relationships before they ever get to a technology deployment. So I think it's I don't want to say there's one thing that's going to, the biggest thing or the one thing or the most important thing. I think it's different from location to location. It's just making sure that people have a clear-eyed view of what they want to get to, dig in to know where that white space is or where those blind spots are, and then devise a plan that you can then deliver in an agile method to start your journey. Because at the end of the day, it's a journey with no destination, right? You know, you're never going to be complete because something's going to change. There's going to be a different type of disruption that you didn't anticipate. There's going to be a different consumer demand that no one anticipated. You know, whatever. The human body's going to evolve and people are going to have three arms and now you got to design totally differently. I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, again, like I say, there's no destiny. We're never going to be finished, right? There's always going to be something to improve upon. So make sure that whether it's the business process you're building or not, are not putting you into a corner that you can't get out of, so that you've got platforms and technology and things that can grow with you as an organization, can change as you add a retail arm to your wholesale business or an e-commerce arm to your retail business or whatever it may be, you know, that can adapt as you acquire businesses and you can build on the platform. So again, it's all about starting the journey. That's the most important thing. Make sure you're starting that journey. Identify what you have to be successful along the journey, and then make sure you're seeing success along the way.
And just to bring us to a close, my final thing would be, you know, in recognition of that kind of diversity of strategies, and everyone's kind of maturity is going to be different, everybody's roadblocks are going to be different, everybody's opportunities are going to be different. What's one piece of advice that you would give supply chain leaders in general, like one action point to focus on right now? Now being early June 2025, as we're recording this, what's a good common thing for everybody to think about going after in the very near term?
Look, surround yourself with people who are cooking in the same juices. So as you're looking for partners, and again, you know, specifically talking about software vendors and, consulting organizations, you know, speak to people who are in your industries, who have deep expertise, who can bring solutions that they've already solved before, or you can learn from on mistakes they've already made before. You know, talking to a software vendor who has an ERP solution that supports 150 industries, you probably won't get as much value if you're talking to somebody who's really focused in your industry and has hundreds of customers who they're talking to on a monthly basis, and hearing what's working, what's not working, how people are doing things, and then are bringing that back into the R&D of their product, to the training of their consultants, you know, and just to the betterment and to the community that they serve. So I think it's, you know, the old adage is, as I always say, you know, as much as things change, they remain the same, but surround yourself with people who are facing the same problems, who have solved the same problems. Some may be ahead of you, some may be behind you, but communicate. Don't try to do things on your own. It's not necessary, and people are willing to help and work with you and bring solutions. And then you put your own spin on it, which is what your competitive edge is across your competitors and things. But there's a lot of commonality that people don't have to blaze new grounds. And even if it's AI, there's even commonality there at this point, even though it's in its infancy, you know, these tools are going to get more specialized by industry, and the deeper they can go into your industry, the more valuable they'll be to you than just a generic type, you know, invoice processing thing versus one that ties POs together through and is very specific for your industry and what the reporting requirements are, et cetera, et cetera.
Brilliant. And, you know, to bring us to a close, your final point there mirrors my experience, like brands, retailers, suppliers. People are very willing to share their experiences. They're very willing to talk about what's worked for them, what hasn't worked for them, like how they're approaching particular challenges, how they're going after particular opportunities. There's a lot of that in conversations that you'll be able to have at events and things like that, talking to colleagues and peers. And then the other thing is you have reports like yours, the Sourcing and Supply Chain Tech Report, where people have divulged a lot of this information in surveys and case studies and so on. So from my point of view, that the report is a good read from that perspective. And I think...
Yeah, look, that's why we put that report out, right? So people can learn from it, for us to learn from it, what's on people's mind, what's important to them, so make sure we continue to add value. You know, we hold user groups every year, we hold webinars, we have customer advisory councils. You know, we really, from day one, have tried to build a community and invest in the community. And more importantly than our customers speaking with us, I believe, is customers speaking with each other and really making sure that they're working together to be better. And that at the end of the day will make us better, because then they could speak in a collective voice as the industry, which then fuels our R&D spend, fuels the programs that we're bringing to the marketplace, and then allows us, you know, to give back to them too, from an education standpoint. And again, doing things like this, speaking with you, and talking about what's working in the industry, what we're seeing. And just, again, all, you know, we're all, like I said, cooking in the same juices, fighting the same battles. You know, let's all get some success together as well.
Amazing. Paul, thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Ben, appreciate it. Enjoyed the conversation, as always.
Thanks for listening. We covered a ton in this episode, but I think it's safe to say there's going to be plenty more to talk about in the back half of 2025. Supply chains, sourcing strategies, technology, none of those things is going to stand still over the next 5 or 6 months. In the meantime, keep an eye on the Interline for regular editorials, news analysis, interviews, and much more. And remember that the Blue Cherry State of the Supply Chain Report is available to download through bluecherry.com. That's BLUECHERRY.com.